Good evening. War with Iran is narrowly averted. Japanese internment survivors at the southern border and a plan to cut the U.S. military budget in half. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Friday, June 21st, 2019. Donald Trump has said the United States Air Force was cocked and loaded to attack three Iranian targets on Friday morning, but he called off the strike with 10 minutes to spare after being told the airstrike might kill as many as 150 people. Trump said in a series of morning tweets that he decided late on Thursday that the death toll was not a proportionate response to the Iranian shooting down of a U.S. spy drone off the Iranian coast 24 hours earlier. It would be routine for a president to be informed of the likely civilian casualties when the options are first presented. Republican hardliners bitterly criticized Trump for aborting the strike. Liz Cheney, a Republican congresswoman, told a right-wing radio talk show, "We simply can't allow America's adversaries to think that they can shoot down a U.S. military drone with impunity." Others, including former foreign policy officials, suggested the decision could provide breathing room for a rethink of policy. Gary Sick is an expert on Iran. He served as national security advisor to President Jimmy Carter when the 1979 Iranian Revolution set the two countries on the path to confrontation. Sick says both countries have grown comfortable with their rivalry.
It started at the back in the time of the hostage crisis, failed rescue mission, the attempt of the Shah to come into the country and the problems that created, and then just went on. The United States started applying sanctions to Iran at that time. Iran took a very strong position, was a revolutionary force that didn't need to deal with the great Satan, and so they basically were quite comfortable with our attacks on them and their attacks on us. And basically, nobody has ever been willing to pay the political price to overcome that and to take the political heat that would be necessary to come up with a new template. And as I say, Obama made a very serious effort and expended a lot of political capital, made some real progress, and then it snapped right back to where it was before. So I think that's evidence that this is not just a minor thing. It actually is a very serious problem, and it's not an easy one to solve.
Of the idea that a large, formerly third world country could break out of the web of Western, not just American, but Western involvement and control, and this is going to happen again. We let these people get away with it.
The Iranians were against us. They said they were.
Yeah, right. I mean, they are our enemy. They are seen by Americans as our enemy.
They are, and they see us as their enemy also. And, one of the great purposes of the Iranian Revolution was to break free of what they saw as Western domination, whether that was the UK or Russia or the United States. And the slogan that they adopted was neither East nor West.
Why does this continue?
There are people on both sides that are really committed to each of us, the U.S. and Iran. We each serve each other's purposes as an enemy. Countries need enemies. They need enemies to organize their political ideas, to organize their international behavior, to organize their militaries. And so having a clear, defined enemy is a very useful function for any government. And in the case of the United States and Iran, we have not just one of us, but both have chosen each other to serve that purpose. And until somebody can break through with and convince some of the people involved on both sides that their interests lie in more cooperative behavior, this is going to just go on. And I deplore the thing. I think that it's gone on far longer than it ever needs to be. But there we are. And there's simply no denying the fact that that's where we are at the present time.
What do you think about the current situation? Are we looking at a bad time? Do you think there might be a war?
Well, we came very close to a military strike. We didn't do it. And I think that at this point we have every possibility of sort of now stepping back and taking a deep breath and thinking, all right, where do we go from here? What do we do next? And I would hope that both sides decide that this is a moment to cool it rather than heat it up, and that they will each consider perhaps some form of communication other than shouting at each other in the media.
He didn't blink. Trump didn't blink. That's at the New York Post headline or Drudge Report headline. He blinked. Did he blink?
You know, this basically, he ordered an attack. He called it off. I'm very glad he called it off. I think that was the smart thing to do, but he called it off. And that's just a fact.
Gary Sick is an expert on Iran. He served as national security advisor to President Jimmy Carter. The United Kingdom, along with France and Germany, are due to issue a demarche or a formal diplomatic position to Tehran in the next 24 hours, warning of severe consequences if it goes ahead with its plan to pull out of aspects of the Iran deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Iran has said it will exceed the 300-kilogram stockpile limit for enriched uranium on June 27th. Iran says it will then start to enrich uranium above the proportion required for civilian nuclear fuel. That would put a nuclear weapon within reach. Peter Kuznick is director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University and co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. He says Trump's approach to crisis is endangering the world.
Words and actions, as we saw with North Korea in creating that crisis, and as we're seeing with Iran, do have consequences.
Did he blink? Did he blink when he refused to bomb?
I hope he blinked. I mean, that was if he blinked, it was the best thing he's done since he took the presidency. So, yes, we can say that he did like Obama, and he creates a red line, and then he backs off from the red line. But that's the best thing he's done. With his supporters so far, these things have been shown to have no consequence. They don't take his words literally in any sense.
So that makes him dangerous?
He portrays himself to be a man of peace now.
Is he more or less dangerous because of that?
He's very dangerous. He's much more dangerous than he himself understands that he is. And when his bullying and his militaristic approaches to things and creation of crises and then backing off them right at the precipice to actually going into fighting like he did with Korea, North Korea, it's so easy to miscalculate, to bumble us into a war the way he's going about doing these things. So, I mean, everybody's concerned that he's not going to start a war necessarily willfully and knowingly, but he's going to bumble into a war. He's going to have a war simply by miscalculation, and that also often happens. This situation is certainly the most dangerous one we've got right now in the world. It's not the only dangerous situation, but you have a man like Trump who's completely ignorant, knows no history, does not take briefings. I mean, the fact that he could say that he didn't even find out how many casualties there was going to be until 10 minutes before the operation was going to be launched just shows what we're dealing with, a man who has just no comprehension and no qualifications to be commander-in-chief or to deploy military force.
And what do you think of what when he came out and sent a tweet saying that you made to the Iranians saying you made a mistake and making it sound like he was a street thug saying you messing with me when he really meant you obviously made a technical error.
He pulls everything back. That's the thing about Trump. He's on all sides of every issue, and he'll say things, and then he'll say just the opposite of them. Words don't mean anything. It's the actions. And by sending 2,500 more troops, by sending the carrier strike group, by sending the bombers, by making the kinds of threats in a situation that's so volatile and that could so easily spin out of control. They say that if any Iranian proxy kills an American in any of these conflict zones, then the United States is going to war. I mean, these kinds of threats, then you've got hardliners in Iran. The fact that the United States created this crisis by pulling out of a nuclear deal that was working doesn't mean that the Iranians are good guys just because the United States is playing the bad guy in this situation. And the Iranians have their own hardliners, their own crazies who would like to see a war. And it makes no sense from our standpoint, in a strategic sense, that anybody's going to gain anything from a war in Iran. Do we think that if we invade Iran that all of a sudden the Democrats are going to take over in Iran? That's nuts. It's going to be the even more extremists the greater extremists, the more hardliners, the Revolutionary Guard that's going to gain power in Iran. We saw what happened in 1979. This situation has got a long history. Back in 1953, the Iranians overthrew the president of the United States and imposed a brutal dictatorship. Oh, well, no, I think I got that wrong. I think it was the United States, the CIA, that overthrew the Mossadegh government in Iran. You know, the Iranians remember that history. And then the United States imposed the Shah. The Shah imposed a brutal police state that had power for 26 more years inside Iran. And how would we feel if some country had done that to us? And when you have somebody like Trump in charge who studies no history, knows no history, comprehends nothing about these situations, it's just much too dangerous for anybody to really have any kind of comfort in this situation.
Peter Kuznick is director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University and co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. Advice columnist E. Jean Carroll is the latest in a succession of women who say they were sexually assaulted by Donald Trump. The 76-year-old journalist and writer who has written Elle's Ask E. Jean column since 1993 says she was assaulted by Trump in a dressing room of New York's Bergdorf Goodman department store. The assault allegedly occurred 20 years ago. Carroll claims Trump followed her to the dressing room, pushed himself against, and unzipped his trousers as he pushed his hands onto her genitals in an upcoming memoir in New York Magazine. The White House said the president rejected the accusations, saying they were created simply to make the president look bad. Carroll is not the first woman to accuse the president of sexual assault or misconduct. During the 2016 presidential campaign, at least 16 women accused Trump of groping, touching, and other inappropriate actions. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. A Trump administration lawyer has disputed in court whether detained migrant children are entitled to toothbrushes and soap. The Department of Justice argued the government was adhering to a landmark ruling requiring migrants to be kept in safe and sanitary facilities. The attorney pointed out the law did not mention soap. But a panel of judges in California questioned the rationale, saying the children were sleeping on concrete. In July 2017, U.S. District Judge Dolly G. found the Trump administration had breached the 1997 Flores Agreement by not providing migrant children with appropriate food or hygienic supplies, housing them in cold facilities without beds. The agreement states that immigrant children cannot be held for more than 20 days and must be provided with food, water, emergency medical care, and toilets. But Department of Justice lawyer Sarah Fabian argued on Tuesday the government had fulfilled the Flores Agreement because it did not specifically list items such as soap and toothbrushes. The hearing comes on the heels of a bitter debate sparked by Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who calls U.S.-Mexico border migrant detention centers concentration camps. Ocasio-Cortez said on Instagram on Monday, "The fact that concentration camps are now an institutionalized practice in the home of the free is extraordinarily disturbing, and we need to do something about it." The New York Democrat emphasized that she was not comparing them to Nazi death camps. On Friday, a group of survivors of the United States internment camps used to imprison 120,000 Japanese Americans during World War II arrived in Lawton, Oklahoma, to bring attention to thousands of children being held in the U.S. immigration detention camps. Fort Sill, Oklahoma, was among at least 14 Army and Department of Justice facilities nationwide where Japanese Americans and Japanese immigrants were interred in relocation centers. A Berkeley, California resident, Nancy Ukari, says 12 of her relatives were detained at a camp in Utah, while 700 Japanese Americans were brought to Fort Sill.
In World War II, 700 immigrant Japanese were rounded up and sent here and were held without due process. And so now that we know from the Trump administration that up to 1,400 migrant children are going to be held here starting in July, we felt as Japanese Americans that we needed to show up. We needed to fly here. So people have come from New Mexico, Wyoming, Washington, California, and New York. Not, there are 25 of us, but people did it. They just sort of put their lives on hold and said, "I need to be there." And we'll have five survivors, the oldest who is 89, who said, "I was there," who want to say, "I was there. I was a child. I need to say, stop repeating history."
And Michael Ishii of Queens is organizer of Tsuru for Solidarity. He also had many relatives detained during the war. He says Ocasio-Cortez, his congress member, was right.
when you round people up, when you forego any due process for them and you strip them of their rights and you put them in indefinite detention, that is a concentration camp. That is the legal definition of a concentration camp.
Mm-hmm. And it's also the term that Franklin Roosevelt himself used and people in the administration used, including the media. At that time, it was not unusual.
Ukhari says the Buddhist religion was targeted back then, as is Islam today.
And just as Muslims are now being decried and there's Islamophobia, during World War II, Buddhism was considered a very serious threat to the national security, and 90 Buddhist and Shinto priests were rounded up and were held at Fort Sill. And so this author is going to be talking about that tomorrow. And he said he was mulling over whether he should have the Zen koan, "How Do Paper Cranes Fly?" Because, as you may know, we've brought thousands of hand-folded origami cranes as a sign, a symbol of solidarity, of peace, of unity, and of healing. And so he's thinking about how to tie our contemporary protests to Buddhism and how Buddhism was the source of religious bigotry then. So he thought, should I relate the classic Buddhist idea of birds needing two wings, one of wisdom and one of compassion? And there also was a priest here named Takahashi Setsu, and he used the guard searchlights to aid his meditation practice, trying to see Buddha in the searchlights as they swept over the camp. And so I think there's a lot of really important history that we can think about and pay homage to this weekend.
According to Michael Ishii, hundreds of Apaches and other Native Americans were also kept at Fort Sill in the 19th century. It's the place where Geronimo died. He adds that the Japanese people want to give a forum to be shared with the Native people.
We want to create a platform for them because what they want is to say, I came back to be with you, to these children. I came to stand with you, to stand up for you, and this is not okay, and we will not permit this to go on.
And Ukhari says people all over the country are coming to protest the detention of the children this weekend. The Reverend and
people from Florida, Pittsburgh, Maine, Hawaii, folded cranes, and they sent them to us, and we took them to South Texas in March, and now we're bringing some of those very cranes to Fort Sill, Oklahoma. So they've become this object that we carry from place to place, and we feel like we're carrying people's voices and their desire to participate and to oppose family separation and really to bird symbolize liberation.
And that was Berkeley, California resident Nancy Ukhari and Michael Ishii of Queens, who are in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, to protest the detention of children who are going to be brought there in July, early July. Some 1,400 are expected to be taken to Fort Sill to be kept. And you're listening to WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. The Reverend Dr. William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign is pushing to slash the military budget in favor of programs for poor and working people.
For the full kind of transformation we need in this country, we must address systemic, and I want to hear this word correctly, policy racism. And we've identified policy racism as voter suppression, immigrant injustice, injustice toward our First Nation people, mass incarceration and resegregation in high poverty schools. Secondly, that is connected to poverty, of which poor people of color have the highest concentration, but white people have the highest in raw numbers. That's connected to ecological devastation. 4 million people, for instance, get up every morning, can buy unleaded gas, can't buy unleaded water, so forth and so on. That's connected to our gross militarism and war economy, where we know if we cut $350 billion from the war economy, we could still have the most powerful military, still be paying more than China, North Korea, Iran, and Russia combined. And then we got this gross moral, immoral narrative, distorted narrative that suggests if you're against gay people and against gay people, against women's rights, for guns, for taxes, that somehow that's a great moral position.
And Lizzie Kashkarian is program director of the National Priorities Project of the Institute for Policy Studies. She's one of the architects of the People's Moral Budget.
There are 800 overseas bases that we control around the world. And many of those are in places like Germany, Japan, and South Korea, where we fought wars in the 20th century, and we've never left. And the same thing is happening now in Afghanistan. And it's time for us to stop the decades-long dispersal of our troops around the world. A lot of the people who live in the places where those bases are not very happy about it. And, for example, in Okinawa, Japan, people just voted over 70% against the U.S. opening a new base there, a relocation of a base. And we're still doing it because the vote is non-binding. So it's time for us to respect other people's democracy, respect other people's sovereignty, and start to close some of those bases. We're the only country in the world that has more than 20 foreign bases, and we have 800.
What would be the effect of this cut? How do we make sure that this money, if you cut it from one hand, doesn't get taken and put in another hand because of the power of these corporate interests?
Well, the power of the corporate interests is a serious factor. More than half of the Pentagon budget goes to corporate for-profit contractors. So that's a major factor. And, you know, this has to come from Congress. And it probably, in order to come from Congress, it has to be something that we, the people, demand. You know, it's time for us to say that we want that investment to come back and to build bridges and roads and build clean energy and create jobs here. There are lots of things that our communities are desperately in need of. There are places in the United States that still, in 2019, don't have access to broadband internet. And we could fix all of those things. We could give health care to every American if we stopped the level of Pentagon investment that we've had for so many years now.
How do you plan to try and get this proposal through?
We're working with some members of Congress on some options to begin to introduce these ideas in Congress. We are working with our grassroots base. We have a lot of people all around the country, both who support our organization and who support the Poor People's Campaign that we worked with on these numbers and other similar organizations to, you know, begin putting pressure on Congress to show them that this is what we want. And finally, on this past Monday, the Poor People's Campaign held a presidential forum, and they had 9 presidential candidates come and answer questions about these priorities, including the cuts to Pentagon spending. And almost every candidate agreed that the Pentagon budget was too big and should be cut.
Isn't it a dangerous world?
It is a dangerous world. It is. But we make it more dangerous, not less, when we think we can control things overseas and when we overextend our military. I think the place we've seen that most clearly is what happened in the aftermath of our war in Iraq, where it led to a vacuum that allowed the creation of ISIS. We don't have the ability to control those things, and so we should be more responsible and more careful about where we involve our military. And we also need to think more about the threats that face us that aren't just military. Climate change already is killing 400,000 people a year around the world. And that's a threat that we're not addressing at all. More people are dying from cancer in this country than are dying from any cause related to anything that we could deal with militarily. So it's time to really start paying attention to the things that are really threats to all of us in our lives, and less attention to things that are big and scary but don't actually pose a threat to us here, and that we can't deal with in a military way with any degree of success. We're proposing $350 billion in cuts to the military budget, and even if we made those cuts, we would still have a military budget that's larger than China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea combined.
Lindsay Kashgarian is Program Director of the National Priorities Project of the Institute for Policy Studies. She's one of the architects of the People's Moral Budget. And that's some of the news for Friday, June 21st, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.